This is The Takeaway for August 21st. Planned Parenthood is forgoing some federal funding over a new rule limiting how they can provide abortion services.
As a low-income family, we've depended on it for feminine health care, exams, and especially when my daughters were young. So yeah, we need Planned Parenthood.
We break down Title X funding and how this move by the Trump administration fits into a long-standing GOP strategy. Also on the show, some states are testing the legal limits of religion in public schools by mandating the phrase, "In God We Trust," be displayed.
When a group that has been dominant feels threatened, one of the things that it might want to do is to find markers of showing, we're still here, we're still the dominant option.
Okay, pod listeners, let's get going. Planned Parenthood is pulling out of a federal funding program over a Trump administration rule that limits the provider's ability to refer abortion services to low-income patients. Conservative politicians have long promised to cut off funding for Planned Parenthood in an effort to motivate anti-abortion voters to the polls.
We're not going to allow and we're not going to fund as long as you have the abortion going on at Planned Parenthood.
We will finally defund Planned Parenthood.
In February, the Trump administration made good on its campaign promises, setting into motion efforts to cut off some of Planned Parenthood's federal funding under the Title X program of the Public Health Service Act. This week, Planned Parenthood backed away from the fight, saying they would forego the funding rather than compromise the organization's commitment to women's health. The move comes on the heels of a leadership shakeup at Planned Parenthood, where the first medical doctor to be president stepped down from her position after disagreements about the role of politics in the organization. But questions remain about what Planned Parenthood's decision not to accept Title X funding will mean for the women who rely most on these healthcare centers. Joining us now are Anna North, senior reporter at Vox, covering gender and reproductive rights. Anna, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Alina Salganikov, senior vice president and director of women's health policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Alina, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
So, Anna, let's start off with you briefly. What is Title X funding and how does it work?
So Title X funding is federal family planning funding, and it's really intended to help underserved populations, so people without insurance or people who are low income, to get services like STI testing, contraception, things like that.
Anna, and what do we know about the connection between what the Trump administration is saying? They're not allowing this organization to provide abortion referrals and tying Title X to that. Can you help us clarify that a little
bit? That's right. So a while back, earlier this year, the Trump administration finalized a rule regarding Title X funding, and critics call the rule the domestic gag rule. And what it says is that if you get Title X funding, you cannot also provide abortions or refer for abortions. Now, Title X funding itself actually could never be used for abortions. So what they're really saying now is not just you can't use this money for abortions, but if you get this money, you can't do abortions at all.
Alina, let's bring you in here. Other than abortion referrals, which is kind of what a lot of folks are focusing on here, what other services does Planned Parenthood provide in terms of reproductive care and women's health?
Oh, well, that's just a very small part of what they do. They provide access to contraceptive services, STI testing and treatment, HIV treatment and other HIV testing and other preventive services. So that's just a fraction of what they do.
And Alina, who will this change affect the most? What parts of the country will be impacted differently?
Well, many parts of the country are going to be impacted. And I just want to add that this change just does not only affect Planned Parenthood. There's a network of 4,000 sites across the country that are participating in the program. Planned Parenthood is about 10% of the sites and 40% of the patients, but there are many other sites, and many states have actually said that they are going to withdraw from the program. So we know in Maine, we know Utah, actually all the Title X sites are Planned Parenthood clinics, many parts of California, Oregon, Washington, Vermont. So many parts of the country are going to be affected.
Anna, what do we know about Planned Parenthood's funding structure right now? I mean, how much of this money from Title X was going to the overall Planned Parenthood budget, and how much did Planned Parenthood rely on this money?
Right. So this wasn't the only federal funding stream that Planned Parenthood gets. They also receive money through Medicaid, and that so far has not been cut off. So they will still be getting federal money. They won't, you know, for instance, have to completely cease operations, but they have said that certain things will stop. They've mentioned that they actually operate a mobile health unit that drives around Ohio offering family planning services and other services, and that may have to stop functioning. And they've mentioned also that wait times will go up at clinics around the country, and they are concerned that patients might go without care.
But Planned Parenthood's entire budget does not come from federal funding. There are also private donors, I understand, that are doing this. Are those private donors going to be able to fill the gap in funding? It's unclear to me whether or not Planned Parenthood has a plan to fill the gap right now.
Right. So they do get private donations also. And they've said, you know, certainly they will try to make up some of the shortfall. Planned Parenthood has known for a long time that this might be coming. So, you know, I'm sure that they've been talking to folks who could provide donations. But they've also said that it's unlikely that private donations would be able to make up this full shortfall, given, you know, this is a longstanding federal program that Planned Parenthood has been part of for a long time.
Alina, you, to your point earlier about this being a nationwide problem, are there alternatives to Planned Parenthood? Are smaller clinics going to have to pick up some of the slack here? Or is Planned Parenthood the only option in large parts of the country?
Well, in some parts of the country, it is the only option. And, you know, there have been studies actually that shown that when Planned Parenthood goes away, when it's closed, the STI rates go up. And Texas had, you know, was an example as well, where the Texas Medicaid program decided to terminate its participation in Planned Parenthood. And what they found was actually that there were fewer claims for IUDs and other and implants, which are long-acting and very effective methods, and actually showed increases in the rate of Medicaid births in the state. In other cases, in Wisconsin, there were also similar cutbacks to Planned Parenthood through state dollars, and they also saw that there were adverse outcomes, and women were finding that they were without providers.
Alina, we asked our listeners about their experiences with Planned Parenthood, and we had a couple of calls. I want to play one from Nikki.
This is Nikki from Arlington, Texas. I relied on Planned Parenthood for regular checkups, for a bout with the flu, and for regular pap exams when I was young because I could not afford health insurance. I specifically went there because they had a sliding scale that I could afford, and there was no judgment.
Alina, is that an experience that a lot of folks who a lot of women in particular who use Planned Parenthood say that they've had? And if so, what impact is this change going to have on that sliding scale that Nikki referred to?
Yeah, actually, our own survey show that upwards of a third of women in the United States say that they have used a Planned Parenthood. Because Planned Parenthood gets Title X, they are able to offer these sliding scales. And because the Title X funds offer the replacement of the cost so that Planned Parenthood is reimbursed for the services that they provide to uninsured and low-income women. So I'm very sure that the experience that your caller had is very much reflected in experiences of other women as well, particularly low-income women who don't have the resources to go to a private doctor or other sites.
Anna, we also mentioned at the top that Planned Parenthood has had its own internal struggles recently. One of them was a leadership shakeup at the very top. Can you tell us a little bit about that and whether or not that was connected to Planned Parenthood's response here?
That's right. So Dr. Lena Wen has left the organization, was the president and the first medical doctor to be president in a long time. You know, that was an issue that was characterized differently, obviously, by her and by some within Planned Parenthood. She really said that the organization wanted her to be political about abortion in a different way than the way that she wanted to approach it. You know, other sources within Planned Parenthood told me and told BuzzFeed that there were management management issues involved too. Whatever the case, I actually wouldn't say that that's related to Planned Parenthood's response here. They've pretty much always said that they will not comply with this domestic gag rule. They really feel that there's no way they can offer a full range of comprehensive family planning without referring for abortion and providing abortion as part of that. And so they've never been really willing to waver there.
So, Anna, would this be considered a strategic decision or one that Planned Parenthood was forced into?
So I think that depends a little bit on who you talk to. Anti-abortion groups will say, well, Planned Parenthood should just stop providing abortions if they want to provide family planning services. Planned Parenthood's response would be, well, abortion is potentially a family planning service. Even if it isn't funded by Title X, they feel that they can't really provide health care, which is a core part of what they feel that they do. They feel that they can't do that in an ethical way without being able to talk about the full range of options that patients can have.
Alina, is it a common experience where Planned Parenthood is not just used for women's health, but also as a primary care center for a lot of women who don't have insurance or don't have other options?
Well, you know, a lot of women during their reproductive years really heavily rely on sites like Planned Parenthood and other family planning providers as their primary source. There's especially the uninsured rate was higher among this group. They're generally a very healthy population, so they don't need other specialty care. So Planned Parenthood and other family planning providers are able to provide the majority of services that they need.
Have past funding cuts led to decreases in services, Alina?
Well, we've seen that, as I mentioned earlier, the case of Texas, where was a clear example where that they had far fewer visits and fewer claims for IUDs, contraceptive implants, injectables, which are the most costly and most effective methods. So those are examples. There are other cases as well in Wisconsin where the state legislature approved family planning cuts, which were directed at Planned Parenthood, which resulted in the closure of 5 Planned Parenthood clinics in rural areas. And they found that even though the women who were referred to other clinics, which were further away, they had waiting lists, and those clinics didn't provide the full range of methods. So we have examples in the past where this has happened and where we've seen decreases in access.
Anna, we know Planned Parenthood is contesting this in court. Where does it go from here?
That's right. So I believe the next hearing in the case is scheduled for the week of September 23rd in the Ninth Circuit. So at the end of next month, we'll find out more.
Anna Nord, senior reporter at Vox, and Alina Salganikov, director of the Women's Health Policy at Kaiser Family Foundation. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're hearing from you. Have you ever relied on Planned Parenthood for health care?
Hi, this is Ruby from Marin County, and as an undergraduate student at UC Berkeley in the 80s, I had 2 unwanted pregnancies, both of which were taken care of safely, affordably, and quietly at Planned Parenthood. I shudder to imagine what I would have done in today's environment.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from San Diego. I used Planned Parenthood for all my health care for several years in my 20s because I moved cities a lot. I didn't have a primary care physician. The only health care I needed was pelvic exams and breast exams and birth control because I didn't have any other health issues, and it was easily available and affordable.
Hey, James Martin, Glendale, Arizona. When I was in high school, me and my girlfriend got pregnant, and we both decided that we weren't ready for a baby at the time. So Planned Parenthood was our only option to end the pregnancy.
Tell us about your experience with Planned Parenthood. You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Caught in the middle of the political battle over Planned Parenthood are millions of women who rely on government funding for basic health and reproductive care. And while the media spotlight often focuses on abortion and Planned Parenthood, Professor Terry McGovern of the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health says there are many other ways that women's access to medical care has dwindled over the past several years. Terry, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So defunding Planned Parenthood has been a rallying cry of the anti-abortion movement for quite some time. Have other Republican presidents gotten as far as President Trump has?
No. He has kind of led the way in attacking access to health care for women.
So let's look back a couple years. I mean, how has women's access to health care in the U.S. now, how does it compare now to the end of the Obama administration, for example? What are the biggest changes you've seen?
So first of all, the administration has dedicated itself to gutting the ACA, and the ACA took away all kinds of categorical kind of requirements for eligibility for Medicaid, so that many, many more women across the country were then going to be eligible for access to care, and that's impacts cervical cancer, breast cancer, heart disease rates. So it's been an assault on access to health care writ large, and he has taken that fight in many different directions. First of all, they went after the non-discrimination clause in the ACA, where because they want to be able to discriminate against LGBT populations, transgender populations. In fact, they have taken a positive approach towards discrimination. They have gone after requirements that employers offer contraception. They have expanded greatly the religious refusal possibilities, and they've actually tried very hard to give states maximum flexibility to provide the minimal amount to its citizens. And what's so fascinating is that you see the states that have the most abortion restrictions also tend to have the lowest cervical cancer survival rates, the highest maternal mortality rates, the lowest amount of programming for children. So there's a real kind of inconsistency and contradiction in this rhetoric around saving children and saving women and the actual evidence of what's happening in the states where this administration has been most successful in pushing its agenda.
Abortion has been really central to at least the political fight so far. There are many that suggest that these are just steps at trying to overturn Roe v. Wade. Do you see that, Professor?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these bills that are being passed at the state level, say in Alabama, are frontal attacks on Roe v. Wade. There is already so many restrictions in place in Alabama. They've made it virtually impossible for women and girls to have easy, ready choice. And so this is just, you know, a total attack on Roe v. Wade. And again, when you really look at what's happening in Alabama, we're talking about women, often women of color, often young women, who desperately need these services. So instead of spending all this money and putting all this attention on abortion, how about looking at programs that could reduce the cervical cancer rate, that could reduce the breast cancer rates, that could take on an obesity epidemic that's driving up costs, healthcare costs around the country? So I find it to be puzzling that all of this emphasis from the GOP on abortion, when there's vast amounts that can be done to improve the health of women and girls and ultimately save money. Because when you don't do prevention, you have catastrophic outcomes that end up costing more.
You mentioned the state of Alabama. What other states can we look at in terms of examples of this latest wave of really curtailing access to women's health?
Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri. Sadly, there's a lot. If you look at, there are 14 states that have not expanded Medicaid, and those states don't provide long-term postpartum care. So we're talking about abortion restrictions, but in this Trump administration assault, we're also talking about care for mothers after they give birth, which is when we know many women die. So it's happening in many, many states. And again, I just wish there were this level of effort towards reducing some of these terrible health outcomes that are completely preventable, like cervical cancer. How could this country have one of the lowest survival rates in the developing world? That is a preventable, treatable disease. Again, you're seeing the impacts worse on Black women, women of color. So we have some serious problems that could actually be fixed if we'd focus less on kind of taking away women's rights around abortion.
Do you have a sense of where this is headed? I mean, we talked a little bit about the worst case scenario for some women who that would be really overturning Roe v. Wade. And with the Supreme Court makeup, we know that that really is becoming part of the conversation. But are there other federal programs aimed at supporting women's health that are threatened right now?
Well, so we have, of course, the public charge rule, which is making it if a woman who is or a girl who is undocumented actually seeks medical care, this can be used to prevent her from becoming legal down the road. So that's a huge issue that's going to create all kinds of fear and confusion. I should say that because people don't necessarily understand that Alabama outlawing abortion in all cases isn't yet the law of the land, it's already created a lot of fear and confusion among around eligibility, where women can show up. If they don't have legal status, obviously they're not going to show up in many cases. So I think, you know, this administration has devoted itself to looking for language around gender or the fetus or anything around women's human rights in any of its programming. So I sadly think that this will continue until, you know, kind of all of the language around women and girls' human rights is stripped from all of our programming.
Professor Terry McGovern of the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In some states around the country, including Louisiana, students heading back to the classroom will be greeted with a slogan we've all heard before, "In God We Trust."
So it's not just Louisiana, it's 11 states across the country have mandated that the national motto, "In God We Trust," be displayed somehow on the walls of public schools.
That's Patrick Hornbeck, a scholar of religion and law and chair of Fordham University's theology department.
The Louisiana bill in particular, which just took effect, says, well, there's already a sort of civics curriculum and students are supposed to be taught about the flag and national traditions. But now it mandates explicitly that students be taught about the motto.
And as you might imagine, the requiring of any religious display, however innocuous, is sure to cause controversy in what's supposed to be a secular space. The emphasis on the national motto, "In God We Trust," and its usage elsewhere in U.S. civic tradition pushes up against our country's shifting cultural norms and the legal limits of religious speech in public schools.
Many of us, I think, are accustomed to thinking about "In God We Trust" as this long, long-standing historical thing, whereas it's actually from the 1950s. The U.S. Congress adopts it in the 1950s, around the same time that the phrase "Under God" was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. This is a time of anti-communist panic. It's a time, maybe we might say, of concern about atheism, which was connected to communism. The saying goes back to the Civil War, and so Union coins had the phrase "In God We Trust" on them, but it got repurposed in the middle of the 20th century in support of what we would probably think of today as a kind of Christian nationalism. And it seems that the organizations that are behind encouraging state legislatures to pass these kinds of bills have maybe something like that kind of vision in common as well.
You mentioned the Pledge of Allegiance, and I remember being a little girl and having to put my hand on my heart and pledge to allegiance and say those words, "Under God, indivisible." Shouldn't there be, I mean, is there a separation of church and state here? And if so, how do we explain this conflict? Are these laws legal?
Well, Tenzina, you've put your finger on exactly the nub of this question. And I think that whether it's about memorials in the shape of crosses or flags or school prayer, this is a debate that the U.S. and the U.S. court system has been grappling with for decades. Many folks think that the Constitution includes a promise of separation of church and state. And that's actually not true. The Constitution itself only says that Congress can't pass laws respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting its free exercise. But it wasn't until about 12 years later that Thomas Jefferson wrote a very famous letter soon after taking office as president to a Baptist church up in Connecticut. And it's in that letter that he coined the phrase "wall of separation between church and state." And even then, that doesn't really quite define what we mean. So there's lots of people who believe that the U.S. needs, especially in light of our recent history, to move towards a much more secular approach, maybe something like what Western European countries have. Other folks say, well, the use of Judeo-Christian language and symbolism has been part of our traditions for centuries. And others want to actually go one step farther and say the U.S. is, was, should be a Christian country, whatever that might happen to mean.
When I bring it back again to the Pledge of Allegiance, children can essentially opt out. Mm-hmm. They can choose not to put their hand on their heart. They can choose not to recite. This doesn't really give children an option to opt out.
I think one of the best stories that I've read comes from Kentucky, where one of the schools that was affected by one of these laws decided to fulfill its requirements by posting a framed $1 bill on the wall of the classroom. And you know, if you pull out your $1 bill out of your pocket, it does in fact say, "In God We Trust." But I suppose the question that I would want to ask is, you know, in this long-term conversation about how much religion is appropriate in civil, secular spaces, once there's a sort of toe in the door here, could not a really zealous school district decide that they want 10-foot graven plaques in every classroom? And that would, I imagine, be a real challenge for lots of folks who don't identify with the Judeo-Christian traditions.
Is this a response potentially to the changing demographics of the United States? And I don't just mean the changing racial demographics, but also the changing faith demographics in many ways.
That's a great question. And the fastest growing religious group in the U.S. are unaffiliated people. So 30% of those under 35, for instance. And that was hardly the case in the 1950s when these laws were passed. I don't want to make too much of this connection, but there's an analogy to be drawn. In the 50s, many U.S. leaders, lawmakers in particular, were very concerned about shoring up the U.S. as a Christian country, not unlike how in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, a lot of southern states were really interested in shoring up their identity with, for instance, Confederate war memorials, which we've been talking about so much in the course of the last few years. And so it seems to me that one thing that might be in common here is that when a group that has been dominant feels threatened, one of the things that it might want to do is to find markers of showing we're still here, we're still the dominant option. Do I think that the 11 states concerned were deficient in providing their students with civics education? Well, I don't know, but I can't imagine that that's the case. There's something else going on with this legislation, which seems to be directed by a number of special interest groups that are concerned about maintaining what they see as the U.S.'s Christian identity.
This being the United States, one thing that we enjoy doing is litigating, and I can't imagine that there won't be cases taken up against these laws. Do you have any sense of how judiciaries might consider challenges to the legalities of these laws?
There's no single approach that justices, even on the U.S. Supreme Court, take in these particular cases. There's a classic case from the 1970s that said that the test for determining if government action involving religion is valid is you find out, does it have a legitimate secular purpose? Does it favor any particular religion over any other one? And does it serve a compelling state interest? And people defending these particular laws would be able to say, well, there is a secular purpose. This is about teaching children about the customs and the history of the country, and the motto has been adopted by the U.S. Congress, and so students should learn about that. It seems to me that the folks who wrote these bills did so in a way that would insulate them from challenges. Now, I think the place where challenges could come is you have a particularly zealous school district who wants to go well beyond what the bill requires. And parents or students could bring what we would call as-applied challenges. The bill itself is probably okay, but the way it's being implemented violates someone's rights.
Patrick Hornbeck is a scholar of religion and law, and he's also the chair of Fordham University's theology department. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. And of course, you can find us all over the internet on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Leave us a comment, give us a follow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.